Welcome to the original Italian-American podcast, Italian American Life with Frankie D at ItalianAmericanLife.com. Podcasts, moments, books, which is a great segue into my guest today, who is Robin Colucci, the principal founder of World Changing Books. With over three decades of experience in journalism and the publishing industry, Robin is a multi-hyphenated professional. She's a guide, mentor, and strategist for thought leaders ready to see their expertise and ideas become a lasting legacy that changes the world. Under Robin's expert guidance, World Changing Books has helped authors from CEOs, astronauts, and Nobel laureates to emerging voices secure over $6.3 million in advances in a mere 4 years. These authors have successfully landed deals with Big Five publishers, won prestigious awards, and earned bestseller statuses everywhere from Amazon to the New York Times. Robin, welcome to the show.
Frank, thank you so much for having me. I've been very much looking forward to this.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And World Changing Books sounds incredible, and I can't wait to learn more about that. But before we get into all of that, tell us about your Italian family background, where you're raised, and where the family's from.
I'm really excited to have this opportunity. And, you know, I know that some of your guests are first generation American. I am actually third generation American. So both my grandparents were born here in the United States. So it was my great grandparents that were from Italy. And
part of Italy?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you right now. So my Giuseppe Colucci, who was my grandfather's father, was from Avellino, Campania, and his wife Giuliana Petrone was from Benevento, which is just a little inland from the Amalfi Coast. One thing I think was kind of cool about her being from Benevento is it means good wind. And if you kind of break down the name Colucci, it means with the light. So I feel like it's a lot of good karma.
Colucci. Yeah, that's
Colucci,
true.
Right. It's almost con Lucci, right? If you had the N in there, it would be with light. And it was interesting. I haven't visited there yet. I was actually planning a trip to Italy with my daughter when she finished college in the spring of 2020. So you can imagine what happened to that trip.
Bad timing, yeah.
And so we're looking at going with my son and the three of us going in 2026. I'll have more to tell you that about my son too, because he's actually lived in Italy. And then my great grandparents on my grandmother's side, that was Anthony Di Modugno from Puglia. And I wasn't able to get a birthplace on my great grandmother, Josephine, but her maiden name was Di Pietro. And so Anthony, I actually did get to meet my great grandfather. I never met my father's grandfather, and I'll have more to share with you about that. But I did meet my great grandfather once, and he was 100 years old, and I was 7. And at that time, you know, he was pretty infirm and in a wheelchair, and you know, it was shortly before he died. But I did get to meet him. But my mother told me. So the family lore is that he was an opera singer in Italy, and which I believe, because he made sure every single one of his children had to either sing or play an instrument. And my grandmother, Helene Di Modugno at the time, and her two sisters, Lois and Lucille, used to sing on the radio in the 30s. And they were called the 3Ds for the 3D Modugnos. And so they had a little radio gig, a regular radio gig, where they would do these gorgeous three-part harmonies. And
where did that take place?
That was in Connecticut. So They all lived in the Waterbury, Connecticut area. And so it was very, very close family, you know, like Italians are, very loving. And my mom has a great story about my great-grandfather where when she came to meet him, when she was engaged to my dad, he jumped up and took her in his arms and waltzed her around the room, you know, to welcome. So he was a very effervescent kind of outgoing guy, which, like I said, I didn't get to know him well, but all of his children were like that too. So I can totally, it totally jibes. On the other hand, my grandfather's father, Giuseppe, word has it that he was actually not a very nice man. And my grandfather was the oldest of 13 children, and he grew up in Hell's Kitchen, New York. Apparently it was so bad living with my great grandfather that when my grandfather, Ralph Colucci, and Raffaello was my great, great grandfather's name. So that's where the Ralph came from. And my dad was the firstborn son of only by 5 minutes, though. My dad's brother is an identical twin. So,
okay.
And I found out from Paula that we actually had there were four sets of twins in the in that Colucci bloodline in the previous generation. So I guess twins. Well, thank God it didn't show up in mine. But yeah. So he my grandfather. His father was a barber, and all he ever wanted his kids to be was barbers. He didn't want anybody to do better than him. And my grandfather, I guess, got the brunt of his abusiveness as well. So when he was 13 years old with an eighth grade education, he lied about his age and joined the United States Army to fight in World War I.
Wow, that's a young boy to be fighting.
Yeah, my dad said to me one day, he goes, I mean, imagine how bad it must have been at home if he'd rather go to war, you know, than stay. And that was something that didn't even occur to my dad until he was, you know, fully grown man. And after my grandfather had died even. And he lived to be 88. But in his time, he came back from the war. And he was kind of a hustler, really, right? He was managing boxers and running pinball machines and things like that in the Hell's Kitchen area. And then he ultimately met my grandmother. When he married her, he was 38. She was only 19, which, you know, back then, I guess, wasn't as weird as it would be.
Right, exactly.
Then they moved to Connecticut. And he founded a record store called The Record Shop in Hartford. And then he went on to have a few record shops. And this is back in the 40s. And this is kind of interesting because during the 40s, music acts used to promote their records by going to record stores and doing a little performance or, you know, signing autographs or whatever. And so I have pictures of him with the Andrews Sisters and Sammy Davis Jr. And I even have a signed, my uncle has now, but a signed portrait of Frank Sinatra that he wrote to Bobby and Ralph and signed it Frank Sinatra. And this is what so early in Frank Sinatra's career that you almost don't recognize him. He looks like he's 18 years old or something. And so he got to meet all these, you know, legendary music acts. And one of my favorite stories about that time was when Sammy Davis Jr. was performing in Hartford. And he had, you know, he was booked at, you know, one of the bigger theaters in Hartford. And when he and his team went to go to their hotel, they were denied the ability to stay in the hotel because of segregation laws. And in Hartford, Connecticut, by the way, you know, not in the South. And my grandfather said, that's ridiculous. You'll all stay at our home. And so Sammy and his band came and stayed at the house, and my grandmother made a big Italian feast, and they just loved it so much. And that, and you know, and like we, I actually, we have a little thing where he's like, thank you so much for your hospitality. And, you know, it was signed by all the band and everything. But my grandmother got very annoyed at the end because Sammy decided to thank her by, anyway, he got up on her Italian marble table and tap danced on the table. And everybody loved it, but my grandmother was furious.
Wow, that's a great story.
And unfortunately, no one thought to take a picture of that moment because I actually ended up inheriting that table, and it's in my you know, TV room now, actually. So they had a really interesting life, and my those are some little anecdotes about my Italian family heritage.
Oh, very interesting, very interesting. Did you grow up in the Connecticut area as well?
Well, I was born in Connecticut, but I mainly grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then in Baltimore.
Okay.
But always came back, you know, several times a year, and you know, hit the holidays and the summers and the, you know, the family reunions with, you know how it is, like I have lots of second and third cousins, some fourth cousins, but mostly my second and third cousins, and also my first cousins who are like sisters to me because their father is my dad's identical twin. So we feel more like sisters than cousins. And, you know, I just love that. And I'm now the person who hosts the family reunions in the summer, and everybody comes to my house like they used to go to my grandmother's. And I just laugh because when I see my, you know, second and third cousins, they feel like brothers and sisters to me, right? Because that's how it is in Italian families, right? Like you're just family, right? And you have that bond, even though you're not all from the same mother and father, but you still know that you could count on them like a brother or a sister. Mm-hmm. And it's just so fun when we all get a chance to get together and, you know, have a lot of laughs and stuff. Oh, yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. And definitely my advice, please take that trip to Italy because you need to go there. Yeah.
I really do. And one interesting thing is because nobody in the family is fluent in Italian except for one. And that is my son. And he, you know, became really inspired about his Italian roots and started studying Italian when he was 11 years old in sixth grade because his school offered it. So he signed up for it. And he studied Italian all the way through high school. And then his minor was Italian studies when he was in undergraduate program at Brandeis University. And then he ended up doing a Fulbright in Sardinia, where he was teaching English to Italian high school students. And he was living in Sardinia for about 6 months from October 2019 until March 2020. So both my kids lost some of their time in Italy because of COVID.
But at least if you go with your son, you got a good tour guide there.
Yeah, exactly. He actually is fluent because of that time he had in Sardinia where he was speaking Italian all the time. That tipped him over from understanding all the rules that he'd been, you know, because it's like it's one thing to study it in a classroom, but until you're immersed, it's really hard to get it down. And he had an opportunity to do some work in Sicily last summer or the summer before last. And when he went back, he was still, you know, had that fluency. So I'm grateful that we at least have one in the family.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And I am a huge, huge fan and a big proponent of we need to send the young people to Italy. I think that trip to Italy for, 18 to 25 year old, mm-hmm. will probably change their entire ethnic awareness and desire. So I kind of I'm the type where I wish as a community, an Italian-American community in the United States, that we would be more in tune with sending our youth there, because I think it would change a lot. So hopefully.
I got to go to Italy right after I graduated college. My non-Italian grandmother took me. And I remember it was like a revelation, because when we got to Rome, I had no idea how Italian I look until I was in Rome, you know, and all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, I'm with my people. Like, and it was like a whole different level of awareness like you said, of that connection. Cause I just didn't, I don't know, maybe I pictured Romans as a little more Greek looking, like a little darker, you know. I didn't realize I just fit right in, like boom.
And other ethnic groups do this, and I wish we would have more of an emphasis on it. I don't think we do. I know there's little, you know, here and there sending, you know, a few college students, but it's not the same. I mean, really having a effort and a goal to start sending on a yearly basis, but that's just one of my dreams.
And, you know, my son went on a school trip when he was in like eighth grade. So he's been to Italy more than anyone in the family, probably even more than my father ever went.
And that probably really affected him when he went on that eighth grade trip.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. I remember the story of when he got separated from the group at the forum. And, you know, by the...
Wow.
Just like my son. But he figured it out. But I mean, we laugh about like a funny thing happened when I was, you know, on the way to the forum.
You know? Okay. Yeah, exactly.
My son got himself lost when he was 13 years old in the middle of Rome.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Tell us about world-changing books, how this started, what exactly it is, and what you do with this.
Well, it started way back in the 1980s. My first job out of college, I had majored in journalism. I went to George Washington University. And while I was in college, I worked part-time at the Washington Post as a news aide. So, you know, I basically like helped sling mail and pass papers around with the editors and stuff like that. Very menial work, but it was really cool to be in that environment. And then when I got close to graduation, the chair of my journalism department told me I recommended you for a job with a New York Times bestselling author. He needs a research assistant. You should go to the interview, and if he offers you the job, you should leave the post to take it. And I thought that was really strange, because I was at the Washington Post and I was a journalism major, and you know. And he said, no, just go with an open mind. And so I did. And it turned out to be a man named David Wise, who had written the very first expose on the CIA ever written, and, you know, several other really notable books about counterintelligence and espionage during the Cold War, mainly between Russia and the United States, or at the time the USSR and the United States. And it was a really interesting job, and I helped him do 3 books in 3 years. And I thought I was going from there to be a newspaper reporter, and he helped me get a job as a newspaper reporter in Central Florida. So I moved from D.C. down there, and I discovered very quickly I didn't like newspaper reporting. So I thought I was done with publishing, and I quit that job. And, you know, long story how I ended up in Colorado, doesn't matter. But I ended up on a 10-year detour of being in the fitness industry and growing my own fitness company and ultimately selling it 10 years later. And then I was like, okay, fitness was fun, but not my calling. What is my calling? And I was going to like be a business coach for other fitness professionals, because they're terrible at business. And some of my clients started to say, well, you know, what I really want to do is write a book. And I was like, oh, yeah, I could totally help you with that. So that was like in like 2000, 2002, you know. And so I just started doing more and more book projects. And then I realized, oh, it's not publishing I don't like. It's just newspaper reporting I don't like. And so I started building that business. And now what we do is we work with world-class experts. And really what they all have in common is that they are fundamentally reformers. So they are people who can look at an old problem and see a new solution. And they're expert at solving that problem with their abilities, like Dr. Ignaro, who was on your show, who obviously saw a new way of solving an old problem, of understanding, like, why does our cardiovascular system work or not work, and that this key molecule was a big part of that. So this is a good excuse for your listeners to go find that show. But, you know, the point being is our clients are innovators and reformers, and that's exciting to me, to bring those ideas out of the immediate community of that author and help share it with a mass market audience where it can actually cause bigger changes than just inside their own little insular groups. And so that's the inspiration behind World Changing Books. And now I've been doing this for, you know, almost 25 years, and I'm still into it.
So, for example, Dr. Ignaro, who was a recipient of the Nobel Prize. Mm-hmm. So he has the basis for a book, and then you guide him through writing the book, and then
So he
writing all that.
Yeah, and like connecting him with a literary agent who helps him find a publisher for the book, and then selling the book to a publisher, and you know, even advising him through the launch and everything else. So, you know, we start with, he came to me, he'd already written some of his memoir, and, you know, there was some good stories in there, but it needed a lot of work. And so we got busy, you know, getting it cleaned up and telling the story. And, you know, one of the things he shared publicly, so I feel okay sharing, is that what he really loved about the process is he ended up a better writer, because I did not ghostwrite it for him. I coached him. I guided him to write it himself. And he really did truly become a better writer. And it's been very fun to see him applying that in all kinds of other ways, you know.
Well, he seems like the type of man that could just do anything. He's just so accomplished in so many different fields.
Yeah, he even makes a great pizza.
Okay, exactly. So do you go after potential authors, or do the authors go to you?
Most of our clients come to us through referral from other clients, which is my favorite way to get it, to have a new client come to me. But we also, people can find us, you know, some people find us on our website, you know, worldchangingbooks.com. And sometimes I meet them at events, right? So if I'm attending something or speaking at something, then, you know, a lot of times if I give a speech, you know, I'll have a few people come up to me after and ask about if I could help them with their book. And I always am very honest. Like I've sent away probably more people than I've taken on, because if somebody, there's plenty of people out there who will take your money to help you write a book, but I'm looking at, like, is this person in the right position at the right time for this to make sense, you know, and do they have, you know, there's certain things you have to already have going on. And if you're not ready, then a book not only won't help you, but it could become a distraction that would take you away from what you should be doing. So, like, a quick example would be, sometimes somebody will come to me and they've had a really successful career in the corporate sector, right? And now they want to be a consultant. And so people are telling them, oh, if you want to be a consultant and you want people to buy into your program, you should write a book, because that'll help you sell the program. And I literally just talked to a guy not even 2 months ago where I strongly encouraged him to set aside the idea of writing a book until he had actually sold this program and executed it with at least a few people. And he says, well, I did it at my old job. And I said, that's fine, but you didn't have to get the buy-in because the big boss said, this is what we're doing. You know, this is a, you have never sold this to anyone, and you don't have, and you don't know if you can deliver without all that behind you. And all writing a book is going to do is put off your finding out and cost you tens of thousands of dollars in the process, because you're not going to get a traditional book deal with that. You're going to have to self-publish that, you know. So I'm always looking at it, you know, anybody who comes to me, I want to make sure that I can actually help them get what they want and sometimes, or what they need. sometimes what they want, they can have, but maybe not right away. And the ones that are ready to go, I mean, that's the time we all celebrate, right? Because then we can just get to it.
Yeah. And then do you, okay, so after they're published, are you still involved with like eventual promoting of the book?
We can be. We've just recently added what we call premier services, where we help our clients raise their visibility while they're writing the book, and we also can help them and guide the process of them promoting the book. What we do is we contract with trusted providers who can do those, who are expert in those things. Like, we're not trying to be an expert in everything, but I also have seen so many authors flounder, or they're out there in those red, you know, shark infested red, you know, bloody waters of, like, you just don't know who you can trust. There's so many people who claim that they can help you do X, Y, Z, and they don't really have the experience or the outcomes to back it up. And so we vet our providers beforehand. And we also, because we're the hub of the wheel, we can ensure that the author's getting a coordinated effort, and all the providers they're working with, everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And we can set deadlines. Okay, so the website's going to be ready by this time. So when can the podcast be ready to launch within that time frame? You know, and so we're in charge of helping everything flow. So the author, all they have to do is show up and say, I like that idea, I don't like that idea, and then get on with their day. They don't have to think of all this stuff that they don't, it's hard to think of something if you don't know what you need yet because you've never done it, right? So that's how we can help with that. And it's going really well. Our authors seem to really enjoy it.
So no, it sounds great. And so if somebody has a potential book, idea for a book, how do they find you?
Yeah, worldchangingbooks.com. And we have a little button that gives you the ability to schedule a complimentary consultation. And, you know, just go there and get on the calendar, and then we'll talk about it.
And to see if, yes, because it's
not. Yeah, exactly. Because I don't want to.
Your company.
Yeah, right, exactly. I just don't believe in taking advantage of people. You know, you got to, because it's very emotional, the desire to write a book. And so part of my role in that initial conversation is to see, is this the right next move for this person? And if not, what would be the right next move? And it's not like I don't ever want to talk to them again. You know, I have people who I check in with who I've given them some things to do. And then I have one woman, I talked with her once. I said, you're not ready yet. I introduced her to an editor so she could get a regular monthly column in a top online magazine, because I could tell she was a real expert, you know, and it would be a good fit and cheap. And she's been doing that. And she's out, as a result of that, been getting consulting gigs. And she just told me last week that just from our one conversation, she had doubled her income.
Wow.
With the things that she'd been able to do because she followed my advice, you know. And we haven't even talked about working on a book. But, you know, I just saw something in her, and I'm like, all right, let's talk every few months, and let me just kind of nudge you along in your development. And then when you're ready, let's do the book. Yeah.
It's very good. Yes. Yes. Well, Robin, thank you so much for the interview and your time. You're a very honest, intelligent, proud Italian American woman. And I love that. And I wish you all the best. And I wish you a great trip in Italy with your children. I'm sure it'll be wonderful. And you should go to Campania probably.
Yes. Yeah, I think we should do Avellino, Benevento, and Puglia.
And Puglia if you can.
Yeah.
Family comes from would be great places.
Yeah, I think that would be a really exciting trip for all of us. And and I think my cousin Paula even might have a few names for people we could check in with when we get there. So
there
be
you go. Well, excellent. Well, thank you once again. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Mille grazie. Thank you so much, Frank.